The Radio Today programme with Audioboo.
Welcome to the birthplace. This is where it all began. I'm in Marconi House in Chelmsford in Essex. It's the home these days of BBC Essex, but this is where all of radio started. You've probably heard Signor Marconi's famous recording of him going, "Rittle testing." Actually, it probably wasn't him, it was one of his engineers. But anyway, we're on Rittle Road in Chelmsford, and we're here to talk to one of BBC Essex's presenters. He does the afternoon show now. After many years of breakfast, he is Ray Clark, and we're here to talk about his new book, which is a celebration of Radio Caroline. It's called The True Story of the Boat That Rocked. Thanks for having us here, Ray.
You're welcome, Trevor.
We'll talk about your book, if we may, in a minute. But I just want to go away and talk about last week's big radio story, which was the purchase of those eight global radio stations by the Irish media group called Communicore. Most of us, I think, don't know much about Communicore. We know it's run by a man called Dennis O'Brien. I was surprised to discover that it's not just an Irish company. It is literally a global company itself. It owns 42 stations in eight countries. And Dennis O'Brien himself is a multi-billionaire. I thought I'd find out more about Dennis and about Communicore. So I've put in a call to Siobhan Brett, who is the media and marketing correspondent of the Sunday Business Post.
For them to go from not having a position in the British radio market to going to fourth largest is kind of characteristic, I guess, of the way the company would work, from 0 miles per hour to 120, you know, in 10 seconds type of approach. I think he probably sees some possible synergies between British and Irish stations. Certainly over here, he lately has moved a lot of the Communicore stations that are national and some of the Dublin-based ones into, say, a single building. And they do benefit from the linear management structure, which lets them work together but separately. This can also be seen in another one of O'Brien's companies here in Ireland, and indeed they have businesses in South Africa and elsewhere, Independent News and Media. He owns a number of newspaper titles, all of whom now have growing digital offerings, and they will often share a particular editor. You know, at the moment now they're appointing people over the group as opposed to over, you know, the title as distinct to each other. So I'm probably jumping the gun here quite a lot by suggesting that there would be links between the two necessarily, but in terms of the broader group, surely the proximity of stations in the UK to the Irish stations, much more so than, say, the stations in Jordan or in Latvia, etc., would be clear.
Dennis O'Brien, of course, is no stranger to the law court, so we must always pick our way very carefully through any conversation that we might have about him and his reputation. But let's start here. Is he known in Ireland as being a distant and benign media owner, or is he somebody who likes to get involved with the editorial?
I guess if you ask a different person, you'll get a different answer to that one. I mean, he's a powerful guy. He's one of the five Irish citizens on Sports Annual Rich List, biggest owner of commercial media assets in Ireland. So with that comes a level of, you know, a feeling of responsibility and maybe a desire to have a control to an extent. Whether or not that's exercised is subject to debate. I mean, there have been stories through the years. There have been people making allegations of different parts, but there are also a lot of very, very senior individuals in each of these media organizations that make calls. And, you know, if you want to drill down a step further and ask the question, how representative is their decision making of ultimately what the owner wants to decide? It's very, very difficult to kind of derive at any type of conclusion that can be stood up.
Siobhan, he's known to be a friend of Michael Tabor, who is Ashley Tabor, head of Global Radio's father. They're reputed to play golf together, possibly have a shared interest in horse racing. Mm. Can you imagine that possibly this deal was done on the basis of, you know, "Hello, Dennis, it's Michael here. My boy Ashley's got a few problems. Can you sort him out? Have you got a spare few bob?"
I've got to say, I don't know that it would be that straightforward. We must recognize that Senator Bryan knows and is close with a great number of people with any number of business interests and any number of siblings and offspring and friends as well, who would be interested in having him as an investor, as being in receipt of his backing to drive the businesses every which way. It would be my respectful suggestion that you don't build empires like Communicore or like independent news and media by making show-me decisions that don't have a strong commercial rationale. That's not to say that O'Brien hasn't worked with close friends in the past and done business with them. Of course not, you know, like many others. But I think it would be reductive to suggest that it was a quick and easy deal. You know, no doubt there was some rigorous consideration of what the implications of this and the potential of it for the group.
That was Siobhan Brett from the Sunday Business Post talking about Dennis O'Brien and Communicore. It's the Radio Today programme. After this, we'll talk to Ray Clark about his terrific book about Radio Caroline.
In these days of interactivity with the World Wide Web, make it easy for your listeners to share their voices with you via Audioboo. They simply download the app to their mobile device, record a boo, and send to your station. It's that simple. And just to prove a point, this ad was recorded as a boo and sent in from the corner shop. Audioboo. Sharing voices with the world.
Welcome back. I'm Trevor Dan. This is the Radio Today programme. And as discussed, we're in Marconi House. Oh, you can feel the vibes. And we're going to be talking about another very important radio milestone. It's 50 years, very nearly, will be at Easter this year, since Radio Caroline took to the air. And Ray Clark has written a book about it. I dare say it's the definitive book about the story of the first offshore pirate radio ship, or at least the first one off the coast of England, Radio Caroline, the true story of the boat that rocked. Ray Clark, how are you?
I'm well, Trevor, thank you.
It's very good to see you. You and I used to work together, didn't we?
Yeah.
On a radio station we won't mention. But it seems to me as though this is what really gets your juices flowing. Radio Caroline, it was exciting, it was swashbuckling, it was all that great stuff.
It lit that spark for me. I can remember, I don't know how, but I can visualise now seeing the back page of the Daily Mirror on what must have been Easter Monday, 1964. And we had a big old Echo wireless on a shelf at home. And I can hear myself now saying to my mum, that's that radio station. And on the back of the mirror was a picture of the Caroline ship. And this was only 2 days after it started. So the news of it spread like wildfire. We were out in the marshlands of Essex and just across the way, really, from where the programmes were coming. And we'd heard about it. So this was revolutionary. This was something that swept the nation in hours. Suddenly there was something different on the radio. And it just lit that spark with me from that moment on. I didn't want to drive a train or do whatever jobs I'd wanted to do up until then. I wanted to be a disc jockey, and not just a normal disc jockey. I wanted to sit on a ship and play
and
Beatles records.
And you made it, didn't you?
Well, yeah, it took a long time. But
you got there in the 1980s. Was it as you had expected it to be? They were not really the glory years, the 80s, to be fair, were they?
No. I mean, it was in its heyday in the 60s, but then a completely different audience in the 70s and again in the 80s. And I was out there mid to late 80s on the back of the success that had come from Laser 558. And eventually the money ran out. And one of the cutest bits that I mentioned in the book was the night that, or the day that Laser was towed in or escorted in to Harwich, listening to Caroline that night at about 9 o'clock. And you should have guessed that something was afoot. This is Caroline 576. We'll be closing down early tonight to facilitate some engineering work. Tune in tomorrow morning for the Nick Richards breakfast programme. So 9 hours later, this is Caroline 558 and here's Nick Richards. I mean, they were cute. They saw that 558 was one of the best frequencies around. The BBC, strangely enough, the BBC Essex had their eyes on that frequency. More than that, they'd been allocated 558. And Caroline made sure that they weren't going to get it, and nor was anybody else.
Now, you've called it the true story of the boat that rocked. And that refers to the movie, the Richard Curtis movie. I think a lot of us, whilst we might have found it a pretty funny movie in its own way, did not enjoy the fact that it didn't feel authentic, did
no,
it?
No. The bit, Trevor, that I thought was authentic were about a dozen people from completely different backgrounds, all thrown together in one place and all fighting for the same cause. And that was the one of the many things that I remember with pride of my short time on Caroline is that I was there. He was the council house kid whose dad had milked cows for a living. There was another guy, Peter Phillips, who'd gone to Dulwich College. There was somebody else who'd driven a forklift truck in a bath cube factory. And we were all in this one place together producing radio, and everybody's survival depended on each of the other, and for that one cause, because we believed in Caroline. Yes, admittedly, some of us got careers off the back of it, and you might not believe it, but that wasn't my intention. It was my dream to be on Radio Caroline. That dream came true, and hey, after that, 30 years of working in the radio, so I think I stole in and got away with it, but honestly, that wasn't my intention.
A lot of people look back, don't they, at golden eras of radio. We're going through a period at the moment when people are looking back at the golden era, so-called, of independent local radio in the UK. But I can remember when that was in its heyday, people look back at the golden era of the pirates and the idea that you didn't have a playlist and you just played what you want and all that kind of stuff. Not true, really, was it? You know, back in the 60s, you know, Radio London was as tightly formatted as any. And on Caroline, you know, if you didn't play those major minor records, Ronan was on the phone.
From research that I've done and speaking to people at the time, if we go back to 1965, there were two groups. There was Planet Productions running Caroline. There was Project Atlanta running what had been Radio Atlanta, had become Caroline South. That was leaking money faster than the ships were leaking water. And eventually, Alan Crawford, the man behind Project Atlanta, had run out of money. Caroline South was losing listeners to Radio London and consequently advertisers as well, and the money wasn't coming in. Caroline North, owned by Ronan, run by Ronan, was making money. It was very successful, and it had a much tighter format and was playing the hits. Caroline South was still playing many of the cover versions that Alan Crawford set Atlanta up to promote because he was selling the records with the cover versions on them. So consequently, when Radio London came along, the audience were thinking, well, hang on, I can listen to the Beatles and all of these exciting songs on Radio London, whereas on Caroline South, I'm listening to cover versions of some of the hits. It's not a great deal different to the BBC Light programme. So just before Christmas 1965, Planet Productions bought out Project Atlanta, spent a lot of money, and then lo and behold, Caroline South, 3 weeks into 1966, ended up on the beach. So the ship needed to be salvaged. It was almost a wreck. The bottom was falling out. I've spoken to a good friend of mine, Carl Thompson, one of the engineers, and he was said he was on the way over to Holland and the thing was leaking, so they needed money.
I suppose the point I'm making is, were they any good? You know, do we look back with rose-tinted ears or whatever they would be? And if we actually get out the recordings, I've been doing a bit of this recently, listening to some of the very early programmes that were done by Caroline, particularly when they were doing them on land and then shipping them out, they do sound a bit dated.
They sound dull. And again, a point that I make in the book, how dull and boring must the BBC service have been at Easter 1964 that these tapes of somebody who'd never presented on the radio before, Simon Dee, Christopher Moore, Carl Conway, John Junkin, who were saying, and now the Searchers. And we thought that was exciting. So how dull was what we'd been listening to before?
So what was the impetus for you to write a book? I mean, it's a labour of love, obviously, but you haven't just thrown this together. This has got proper academic level research in it, and it's an excellent piece.
Thank you. It is my mastermind topic. If the Director General said, Ray, you work for the BBC, we need somebody to fill that leather seat on Mastermind, that would be my topic. It is a labour of love, but I've always been fascinated by the topic since Caroline started. And this is exactly how it came about. If we go back to 2012, every year, with the exception of 2013, there's an event in Amsterdam, the Amsterdam Radio Day, and the place is just heaving with anoreks. Poor, sad people that just love listening to the radio coming from ships. And I'd just come back from that, November 2012, and we'd had a great weekend. There'd been a lot of people there reminiscing, catching up with a lot of friends that I knew from radio days, from pirate radio days, and have worked with since. And on the Wednesday, I went to Lakeside to meet up with another former colleague that worked at a BBC station. This is Peter Stewart, newsman. Now, Peter's written a few books, and I got to Lakeside earlier than him. So if you're a guy and you're stuck at Lakeside, what do? You go and look around Curry's or Dixon's, then you go to the Apple shop. And then what else is there? So, Waterstones. So I walked around Waterstones, looked at all the music books, same old stuff about Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, sort of bought those, got those. Television, yeah, the history of Coronation Street. Yeah, I've seen that as well. Radio, Life in Ambridge. And you thought, yeah, well, okay, the Arches is brilliant, but I want more than that. Where's the Caroline book? And it really was a sort of flash of inspiration. Perhaps somebody should write it. Perhaps I should do it.
Well, it's an excellent piece of work. And when's it actually published, Ray?
Well, there's a debatable thing. It was published last week, but I had an email just yesterday from the publishers saying stock should be into the warehouse now. So I think, yeah, I don't know how the world of books works, but I think the printers had a load on, but possibly from bits that I've gleaned, they've printed more than they were originally going to, because response already has been quite good. So I hope that's the case. I think that's the case. I like to believe that's the case. So I'm led to believe that from the 15th of February, it will be available in book and electronic form.
Well, it's very good. It's a good read, and it's got some fantastic pictures, including many in colour that I've never seen before. Radio Caroline, The True Story of the Boat That Rocked, is written by Ray Clark. Ray, thanks for having us here. Let's just go off and have some radio news from Roy Martin.
Thank you, Trevor. The headlines this week. It seems like old news already, but Global Radio has sold 8 radio stations across the UK to Communicorp. The Dublin-based company, which is the biggest independent radio operator in Ireland, will franchise a number of Smooth, Heart and Capital stations. LBC has gone national. It is now available on Digital One in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. And the station now stands for Leading Britain's Conversation. Or if you were looking at all the cakes from launch day, London's biggest cakes. And iTunes Radio has launched in Australia. Rumours are the UK isn't far behind. Well, there's something to look forward to. And that's the latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
UK-voiceover.com.
Audio production starting from £3.
UK-voiceover.com.
On Twitter at UK Voiceover.
Given how much we love radio, it's not surprising that Valentine's Day is a pretty decent one to choose for a launch.
Welcome along to Talk Radio UK. What a day, what a day.
What an exciting day. It's sort of freaky being in here with 5 million film crews outside and lots of people staring at us. I mean, you know, this is supposed to be relaxed. It's supposed to be breakfast.
I have to ask
Give
you
Give me
something.
Croissant. What?
I'm not giving you a croissant. I'm sorry. Are you shocking?
I'm afraid I'm not terribly.
I think the original founders of Talk Radio thought an American style of speech radio would work in the UK, and it actually didn't. And the reason is we're different in the UK and we want different sorts of radio.
Paul Robinson, later managing director of Talk Radio UK, which then became Talk Sport. The station launched this week in 1995, the last of the 3 national commercial stations to come on air. New Radio Love also came from Leeds this week, 17 years ago.
For the first time across Yorkshire and the East Coast, a radio station that's fresh, young and truly innovative.
KISS 105. Ready or
not? The launch of KISS 105, later Galaxy, now Capital, this week in 1997. And from the BBC, this week 46 years ago, a star-studded coastal launch featuring the likes of Dora Bryan and Laurence Olivier.
This is BBC Radio Brighton.
The sea will always be a grand object and is generally accompanied with some circumstances of beauty. But here, it is adorned with no rocky shore, nor winding coast, nor any other pleasing accompaniment.
Wonderful stuff. This week, 25 years ago, hello to BBC Hereford and Worcester.
A very good morning, I'm Jeff Roberts. Welcome to Breakfast Live, the first Breakfast Live on BBC Hereford and Worcester. On this morning's programme, we pose a question about the top of the Malvern Hills.
Jeff Roberts launching another BBC local station this week in 89. Also with BBC locals, this week 14 years ago, BBC Radio Oxford returned. It had spent some time as Radio Berkshire and also as Thames Valley FM. This week in 1973, preparations for local commercial radio were beginning, and on the 8th of February, the winners were announced for the London franchise battle. John Whitney was involved in one of the 13 applicants, albeit he'd received the disappointing call to say that he hadn't won.
I think I took off in my Mini Cooper F down to Dorset to bury my sorrows in the wetlands of Dorset and Archie, where we lived. And it was very shortly after the announcement that we had Richard Attenborough's group had won that I got this telephone call from him.
John Whitney reflecting on this week 41 years ago and his invitation from Capital to join their winning group. And later John crossed the floor to the regulator, the IBA. This week last year, it was farewell to a great BBC announcer.
BBC Radio 3 on VHF and on 1215 kHz, 247 metres medium wave. Good morning, everyone. For today, Friday, the 4th of July, it's Patricia Hughes in London. And in a few moments, we'll hear the time signal for 7 o'clock. The news.
Patricia Hughes, who died this week in 2013. She'd started at the BBC as a secretary in 1944. Then she was on air on what they call the Overseas Service, moving to the Light Programme, the Home Service, then the Third Programme. Remembered now so fondly as the elegant voice on Radio 3. Radio came to Wales this week, 91 years ago.
This is 5WA calling, the Cardiff station of the British Broadcasting Company.
I mean, it was quite an honour for me, and I look back now and I think of that little place, you know, in Duke Street, with that thing hanging down there.
It was the mic, you know, like when we used to make records in the old days. What a different thing it is now.
5WA launching in Cardiff. This week, 17 years ago, magic began to spread north as some of the northern AM stations changed brands.
Billy Ocean, so coming on the way, we'll have a selection of the sort of songs you'll hear on the Big Easy Magic AM to take us through till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Listen out for the station you asked us for, the Big Easy Magic AM. I'm Al Dupre, and this has been Great Yorkshire Gold. Your
baby does. This week in 97, the end of Great Yorkshire Gold and the start of magic outside London. In the 60s, the pirate stations weren't just on ships, they were also on old wartime forts. Radio City broadcasts from some ocean towers 7 miles off the Kent coast. But this week in 1967, the station prepared to close as legal battles raged about whether the fort was or wasn't in territorial waters.
For me, Tom, it was for the very last time on Radio City. It's a very good night to you, ladies and gentlemen. God bless, and thank you for being a marvellous audience. Good night, and goodbye.
Goodbye, Radio City. So, with Ed Stewart beginning on Junior Choice this week, 44 years ago...
Hello, darling!
The Competition Commission originally pronouncing on the global acquisition this week last year, and Saga East Midlands launching 11 years ago.
And this is your captain speaking.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments! Thanks very much indeed, David Lloyd. Thank you to Roy Martin. Thanks to BBC Essex for having us, and to Ray Clark for talking about his book. Thanks to Siobhan Brett as well. This has been the Radio Today programme, a TDC production. I'm Trevor at trevordan.com. And I'll talk to you next week.